You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth. Hey!
Spanning the globe to bring you the latest developments in medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja. We love the earth. It's time for the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville. Now, here's your host, Russ Belville.
Good day, tokers and tokettes and non-toking lovers of liberty. It is Tuesday, December 19th, 2017, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. Welcome to the program. We're a little hectic here back at the studio after being gone for 2 weeks. Made my way to Jamaica for my annual vacation, followed by a short trip to Texas where we got a tattoo update. We got some CBD now. CBD on the right arm to go with the THC on the left arm. And then the last 3 days I spent in Vegas. I'm wearing my Vegas Strong t-shirt today. Was attending the 2017 Las Vegas Bowl where the Boise State Broncos made it 3-0. In their three meetings over the Oregon Ducks, and 4-0 as members of the Las Vegas, participants in the Las Vegas Bowl. So great job. A great vacation was had by all. We're all recharged and ready to go, ready to attack the latest news that's happening in the world of cannabis. And on the show today, at the end of the program, we're going to have time for some drug war data mining, because in the data mines today, we've got to look at the most recent release from the National Survey on Drug Use and Health. It's the 2015-2016 state level numbers, and they show some remarkable changes when it comes to teenage marijuana use, both in Colorado and Washington State, giving lie to the fears of prohibitionists like Kevin Sabet, who said legalization would lead to more teenage use. We'll get right down to the details and some shocking statistics that weren't covered in any of the other reports that I've read on this, so stay tuned. Coming up a little later on in the show for our drug war data mining. Also coming up on the program today in What in the News, we're taking a look at those raids out in Denver where 13 employees of the Sweet Leaf dispensary chain are being charged with over-serving, basically violating possession limits. We'll talk about that in What in the News and just about how dumb that is. Also on the program today, we're going to take a look at some of the best events that we covered in 2017 this week, and one of the big ones was the Drug Policy Reform Conference 2017 in Atlanta, Georgia. We're going to talk about policing in the war on drugs era. That's all coming up here on the Marijuana Agenda. But first, as usual, let's get to the cannabis headline news.
This is your cannabis headline news, brought to you by MarijuanaMoment.net, the complete source for all your marijuana news in one morning newsletter from Marijuana Majority founder Tom Angel. Subscribe today for free at MarijuanaMoment.net.
This is your cannabis headline news for Tuesday, December 19th, 2017. I'm Russ Belville. Last week, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions held a behind-closed-doors meeting about marijuana with anti-legalization activists. Now, thanks to the fact that Sessions inadvertently showed an agenda for the meeting to a live TV camera that was in the room, along with some high-tech sleuthing, we know what the prohibitionists discussed in secret after the reporters were kicked out. A Twitter user with the handle Mental Motion was able to enhance a screen capture of the document that Marijuana Moment posted. The document appears to read, Agenda, Bertha Madras, marijuana is not a substitute for opiates as a pain medication. Dr. Hoover Adger, the harm from today's marijuana. Dr. Bob DuPont, the effect of marijuana on drug driving. And David Evans, the role that the FDA can and should. And then the rest is obscured. The enhanced photo makes clear that the anti-legalization activists made a concerted pitch during the meeting to convince Sessions to launch a federal crackdown on states that have ended cannabis prohibition. Vermont appears poised to become the next state to legalize marijuana, and according to top elected officials, it is likely to do so within a matter of weeks. Last week, House Speaker Mitzi Johnson, a Democrat, said she expects, quote, it likely will pass in early January. Days earlier, Governor Phil Scott, a Republican, said he is comfortable signing a cannabis legalization bill into law in early 2018. And on Thursday, Senate President Pro Tempore Tim Ash, a member of the Progressive Party, said he and his colleagues, quote, look forward to working with the governor to make sure that the bill gets to the finish line, end quote. If the tripartisan group of officials follows through and enacts legalization in early 2018, it would make Vermont the first state to end cannabis prohibition by an act of lawmakers. Custom postage stamps may not contain any images of marijuana, even though some depictions of alcohol, tobacco, and guns are allowed. That's part of a final ruling the U.S. Postal Service is expected to release this week. Quote, to be eligible for use in customized postage products, images and/or text must meet criteria established by the Postal Service, the agency says in a new filing scheduled to be published on Tuesday in the Federal Register. Continuing, quote, acceptable commercial or social images or text must not contain content that is unsuitable for all ages audiences, including but not limited to any depiction of controlled substances, including but not limited to marijuana, end quote. The Trump administration is expected to finally answer a WhiteHouse.gov petition on industrial hemp that garnered enough support to warrant an official response back in February. Quote, industrial hemp was once a dominant crop on the American landscape. This hardy and renewable resource was refined for various industrial applications, including paper, textiles, and cordage, reads the petition submitted by Eric Steenstra, president of Vote Hemp. We request that President Trump work with Congress to pass hemp legislation in 2017, end quote. Earlier this year, the hemp petition earned more than 115,000 signatures on the federal government's We the People site. But even though the petition garnered more than the 100,000 signatures that, under a policy started by the Obama administration, was supposed to require an official response within 60 days, the Trump White House never replied. It also never responded to 16 other petitions that met the signature threshold. But on Monday, the Washington Examiner and other news outlets reported that the Trump administration is relaunching the online petition tool next month and will begin issuing responses to those petitions that already got enough signatures. Massroots founder Isaac Dietrich has successfully engineered the departure of board members who ousted him as CEO earlier this year and reinstalled himself at the helm of the company. The social media company Massroots has boasted thousands and thousands of followers, and the scandal has shaken up the marijuana finance industry. This has been your Cannabis Headline News for Tuesday, December 19th, 2017. I'm Russ Belville.
You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville. The Marijuana Agenda is a listener-supported independent podcast brought to you by Radical Russ Media, LLC. Subscribe to our VIP feed at MJAgenda.com for access to our ad-free podcast segment archive. Make a one-time donation to support the Marijuana Agenda at paypal.me/radicalruss. The Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
Law enforcement is a part of the answer. It's part of creating a climate of hostility to drug use in America.
Whatever you're smoking, it's not marijuana.
Looking for the 420 friendliest way to visit beautiful legal potland Oregon?
I'm Lori Duckworth, inviting you to come stay with us at Delta 9 House and Studios.
You get your own private room with queen bed and access to our high-speed Wi-Fi, premium entertainment system, and more.
We'll even cook you breakfast. Look us up on Facebook at Delta 9 House.
That's facebook.com/Delta9House. Delta 9 House is booked through Airbnb.com, City of Portland, permit number 17-159855.
People should say no to drug use.
It's really, really easy.
Adding more gasoline to the fire.
Lackadaisical.
Really tough, really big, really great to infect and rot our nation.
Dangerous and gateway drugs.
We don't need to be legalizing marijuana.
To build and grow a stronger, healthier, and drug-free society.
What, what, what? In the news.
Today in What in the News, we take a look at one of the biggest marijuana dispensary chains, Sweetleaf, which I got to tell you, we've got a Sweetleaf location just 8 blocks away here from Delta 9 House and Studios in Portland, Oregon. But this concerns the Sweetleaf locations, 12 of them, I believe, in Denver, Colorado, and they've all been shut down. The Denver police raided them. This story goes back to the 14th. And the Denver police raided them and had search warrants issued. They've suspended 26 of their licenses for retail, processing, wholesale, and so forth. And now they're still closed with this raid having happened. And 13 bud tenders at these Sweetleaf locations were actually charged in this particular case. And the Cannabis has reported on this. They cite that the 13 people arrested Thursday in a year-long investigation into suspected illegal marijuana sales at Sweetleaf marijuana centers were bud tenders. The criminal activities alleged include sales of cannabis in violation of Colorado law. And here's the catch. They're saying these bud tenders sold to individuals more than the 1 ounce of marijuana they are allowed to sell in any one particular day. The owners of Sweetleaf are not named in any of these charges. So the guys that, you know, the big money men who make the bucks coming in off of this, they seem to be okay. They're going after the low-level employee bud tenders on this one. Investigation still ongoing, but what we have uncovered so far from the search and arrest warrants show the suspension of, like I said, 26 licenses, raids of 8 locations in Denver and Aurora. These violations allegedly occurred in December of 2016, January 2017, July, August, and October of 2017 as well. And according to the story in the Cannabis, on each date, an undercover detective entered a single location multiple times. As few as 5 times, and as many as 16 times, during windows of time ranging from 59 minutes to 5 hours and 50 minutes, according to the affidavits. They'd go in with a hidden camera and provide the ID to the employee behind the glass window, and then they would escort the person into the dispensary. The bud tender would then typically purchase the special, identified as 1 ounce of marijuana for $120. Let me repeat that. 1 ounce of marijuana for $120, with strains including Afghani, Blue Dream, Cheesequake, or Tangerine Kush, according to the affidavits. Minutes later, the detective would walk back into the store and make another 1 ounce purchase, often from the same bud tender. The arrest affidavits for the respective bud tenders outline how each of them allegedly made at least 2 same-day sales to an undercover detective. Those sales allegedly made by respective bud tenders totaled anywhere from nearly 2 ounces to close to 5 ounces. And the time between these were, let's see, within a couple hours to 5 hours in between the purchases. So here's a couple of things we could say about this. Number one. Why do we give a shit how much weed someone is purchasing at a time? Never have I gone into a liquor store and have they said, I'm sorry, you can only purchase 1 bottle of liquor here. You can't load up your cart with 20 bottles of liquor. You just can't do that. Well, we know why they limit us. It has nothing to do with the safety. It has nothing to do with the safety, obviously, or they'd limit how much alcohol you could purchase. You'd be limited to how many cartons of cigarettes you could purchase, and you're not. The reason why is because marijuana is not legal in Kansas. Marijuana is not legal in Oklahoma. Marijuana is not legal in Utah. All these states that border Colorado. And so they set this 1 ounce limit on your purchase because they don't want you to go buy a whole bunch of $120 ounces and then take them across the border to Kansas and sell them for $300 each. So it's not having anything to do with the harm of marijuana and how bad it would be if someone had more than an ounce of it. It has to do with trying to clamp down on what they call smurfing, which is, you know, sending in straw purchasers to buy a whole bunch of product and then take it to another state to sell it illicitly. So these bud tenders, now let's give these bud tenders some benefit of the doubt on this, right? It's bad enough they're going after the low-level employee. And the way they write this story makes it sound like here's bud tender and Joe Cop comes in and he sells him an ounce. And then 1 minute later, Joe Cop comes in again to the same bud tender and he sells him another ounce. And we're supposed to go, aha, see this bud tender. They obviously know. They obviously know this guy's buying more than an ounce. I don't buy that. I don't think it's as cut and dried in that. First of all, some of these dispensaries get real busy. They get very, very busy. And so you get a lot of customers coming and going. And so if a bud tender is serving, say, 50 customers a day, I don't know how many they'd serve. Let's say it's 50, 20, whatever it is. Are we really expecting that bud tender to keep in their memory how much they sold to each person they've seen and keep those numbers attached to the faces they see? Right? You're supposed to go, oh, wait, Joe Kopp, you came in a half hour ago and you already bought an ounce. They're supposed to do that by memory in, on a busy retail floor when they're trying to keep track of everything that's going on and answer everybody's questions. I don't think so. And this brings me back to the guys that own these shops. If this is how Denver PD, if this is how the states going forward are going to proceed with trying to maintain cannabis regulations by going after the low-hanging fruit of busting a whole bunch of bud tenders in their 20s, then these owners have the responsibility of setting up some sort of system to track who's buying what when and make sure that no bud tenders can violate that system. But now we get into the range or get into the realm of us, the general public, having our every cannabis purchase tracked. That's what we're going to have to do. These stores are going to have to say, oh, see, Russ Belville, okay, let's get you in the computer. And, oh, you already bought an ounce today. We can't let you in. That's the way it's going to have to be. There's going to have to be some sort of check that is not at the bud tender level. And again, most bud tenders, we're not talking about folks that are, you know, going to keep track of everybody that they see and try to memorize that kind of stuff. Certainly not for the level of wages they get paid. This is incumbent on the store owners to protect their employees and, in a larger scale, protect our burgeoning industry. Anytime there's raids like this and stores shut down, the details are irrelevant. It sounds like to the general public, problems with legalization. See, we gave them an inch and they took a mile. See, we couldn't trust them. And you know people like Kevin Sabet are going to play that up. Here's something to think about when you see news stories like this. Put the news story up on a bar TV with the sound turned off and see how it looks to just the average person who doesn't pay attention to weed, doesn't know anything about the industry, and they just look up from their drink and they see raids, Denver Sweet Leaf, marijuana, and they just think that there's a problem going on. So it's incumbent upon these business owners to make sure that we come up with some way of making sure that a customer can not overpurchase, and more particularly, that these undercover cops can't come in and overpurchase. Now, I'm generally against the idea of tracking our consumer purchases here. So there's got to be a way to pull this off. There's got to be a way in which we can protect our employees, protect our people, and maintain the privacy rights that we as cannabis consumers all deserve. But to go after these low-level employees seems absolutely cruel. We're talking about people in their 20s, let's see, as young as 25, Natalie Betters, Leanne Henley, and here, two of these bud tenders are 22 years old, and they're booking photos right here in a slideshow on the Denver Post for everyone to see. This is not what we deserve. This is not the way the cannabis industry should be treated. It's not the way this product should be treated. And again, any problems that we have with legalization are really a problem with continued prohibition. This wouldn't be happening if cannabis were legal in all 50 states. This wouldn't be happening if cannabis sold for its natural production price of around $12 to $15 an ounce. This only happens because of the pressures that prohibition puts on us, the profit motive for being able to take that product over state lines to be able to make a buck off of other people going to jail in states that still maintain prohibition. So keep reiterating that and pointing out that the Denver Police Department is not really going after what the public would want us to see. Nobody was clamoring, aside from Kevin Sabet, for a shutdown or a investigation into these shops. Nobody was worried that there was a big problem with weed use. And in fact, when we get to our drug war data mining at the end of today's show, we'll show you how Colorado's regulation, legalization, ending prohibition is actually doing everything the prohibitionists would like to see but could never achieve.
Look at yourself before you pass judgment.
You're right, President Obama. That's a very important point. Hey, folks, it's 3:20 here in the Pacific time zone. That means it's 4:20 there in Denver, Colorado. This one goes out to the Denver Police Department. Be right back after this important safety briefing.
If you work in the cannabis industry, consume marijuana, or just support freedom, you need to know about breaking policy news that affects you. Marijuana Moment is the daily newsletter that helps you stay on top of all the latest and most important state, federal, and international cannabis developments. Brought to you by longtime legalization activist Tom Angel, Marijuana Moment puts a concise yet comprehensive overview of cannabis news in your inbox early every weekday morning. Wake up to Marijuana Moment and rest assured you'll be ready for the cannabis news that's driving the day. Subscribe now at marijuanamoment.net.
The marijuana agenda, like the gay agenda, only with better music. Now, in the interest of fair and balanced journalism, the marijuana agenda presents this anti-drug public service announcement.
Prescription painkillers were totally safe. They lied. Find out the truth about prescription painkillers. Drugfreeworld.org.
This has been an actual anti-drug public service announcement. To combat this and other drug war hysteria, listen to the Marijuana Agenda every weekday at 3 p.m. Pacific at live.mjagenda.com or download the free podcast at mjagenda.com.
New beginner guitars and banjos are often constructed much better than ones built before your time. Why struggle? Get a new instrument or fix the old one. The trusted professionals at the Fingerboard Extension will evaluate your instrument for free. Repairs are priced for people who work for a living. Stop by the Fingerboard Extension downtown Corvallis at 120 Northwest 2nd Street today or check out its inventory on the web at fingerboardextension.com.
The Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
And let me be clear about marijuana. It is a potentially dangerous gateway drug that frequently leads to the use of harder drugs.
Whatever you're smoking, it's not marijuana.
Hey everybody, it's Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda, inviting you to be like me and get your ink done at Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo, Fort Worth's most female-friendly, clean, sterile, awesome tattoo shop. Thomas and his crew are true artists who can design you a custom piece or use a design you bring in. Lucky Horseshoe also offers all styles of tattooing as well as piercings and all-around fun. In the DFW area, stop by Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo and tell them Radical Russ sent you. Trust me, it'll feel awesome.
This is the Drug Policy Reform Update. The war on marijuana is just one aspect of the global drug war that corrupts governments, enriches criminals, and imprisons consumers. While marijuana may be safer, that doesn't mean other substances should be criminalized. Learn why legalizing all drugs should be every cannabis reformer's goal in this edition of the Drug Policy Reform Update.
police abuse in the name of the war on drugs. Could you talk a little bit about how you see policing the war on drugs and particularly the impact on women of color working in, and what solutions you might find to the problems with that?
Certainly. Thank you. So I apologize so much for being late. I was on a solutions panel at Afropunk, so you're seeing me like right after I was the coolest I'll ever be in my entire life. Everything else is like, you know. Anyway, I am a Black lesbian immigrant. I have been working on issues of police violence against Black women and women of color for the last 20 years and just published a book on it. And the war on drugs is definitely at the center of my work because it's one of the primary sites of mass incarceration and criminalization of Black women. We know the war on drugs to be the driver of the continuing reality that Black women are twice as likely to be incarcerated as white women, even as those racial dynamics are changing through meth and opioid and different patterns of prosecution. I just don't want us to forget that Black women are still being criminalized at twice the rate. And then looking at the police interactions that are driving that. And I think that we think a lot about racial profiling, but don't think about how it takes racially gendered forms, and that there is a profile. We all know kind of maybe about the welfare queen profile of Black women, but we think about there's a uniquely racially gendered profile of Black women as drug users and as drug concealers. And as maybe low-level drug sellers also, that permeates every interaction with Black women by police officers. And so, for instance, just the other day, a Black woman was shot by police in Miami Beach. It's a long, complicated situation, but basically, the initial reaction is she must have been on drugs. And then somehow that justified them shooting her in a situation where they could have done something else, right? So she was actually, I think, in the middle of a mental health crisis, but the assumption was that she was on drugs and therefore needed to be stopped by lethal force if necessary. And so that also leads to the kinds of strip searches that we've been hearing about, public cavity searches of Black women. Charnesia Corley is a woman who, if you Google her, you'll find a video of her talking about being pulled over at a traffic stop for failing to stop at a stop sign. Which, how many people have failed to stop at a stop sign? Right? You've never done that because you know better. But in that situation, then, you know, the officer claimed to smell marijuana on her, made her wait an hour for a woman officer to show up, who then pulled her pants down, threw her on the ground, pulled her legs open, and for 11 minutes probed her insides. So I say that not to re-traumatize folks or to reproduce kind of the violation of Black women's bodies, but to say that is how the war on drugs is waged on Black women's bodies, and that is normalized by the war on drugs, and that is presumed by the war on drugs. And I just want to give another example that's maybe equally traumatizing, just to prepare you, of a Black woman named Frankie Perkins in Chicago, that these things can be fatal as well. So Frankie Perkins in Chicago, officers saw her kind of in a vacant lot on her way home, assumed that she was engaging in drug activity, and believed, they say, that she had swallowed the drugs. So they threw her down and choked her, trying to get her to spit them up, and choked her again. That's how the war on drugs is waged on the bodies of Black women in America, and we just don't, like, we're sort of talk about the mass incarceration part of it sometimes. We talk about women like Kendra Smith or Susan Burton, and we need to talk about that, but we also need to talk about women who maybe don't make it to a jail cell because they're killed or because they experience that kind of sexual violation, and then they find nothing, so they're not mass incarcerated, but there's been a huge impact on them in the meantime. And then the war on drugs is also a real driver of police sexual violence, which is a very systemic issue in the United States. It's a weapon of police brutality. It's the second most frequently reported form of police misconduct, but it's not the second most frequently talked about. And the war on drugs is a primary site, because if you say to someone, you could do 25 years for this, whatever I'm gonna plant on you, or say you have, or that you have, or you could do this for me, it's a fairly common thing. It just happened in New York City last week to an underage teenager. It happens on the regular. So just want to name that. You've heard a lot from Lynn Paltrow and others during this conference about how the war on drugs is waged on the bodies of pregnant people, so I won't reiterate that. I will say, for instance, I don't know if you've heard this as much, that, you know, for trans and gender nonconforming folks who may be using hormone replacement therapy and have syringes on them, there's a presumption that those syringes are about drugs. And there's actually a huge amount of profiling of queer folks as drug users and couriers and carriers too, and that often those charges are the ones that they'll use to criminalize kind of public expressions of gender nonconformity or sexual nonconformity. So I list that parade of horribles to then say, when we're thinking about solutions, we need to go there, right? And so when we're talking about reparations from the drug war, I want reparations for every time a woman had to give someone oral sex, a police officer oral sex, in order to avoid a drug charge or in the under threat of a drug charge. I want reparations for every woman who's lost a kid because, you know, she had a blunt on her, and, you know, every other white woman who drank excessively and never lost her kid, right? Like, I want reparations for those kinds of manifestations, and I want us to think about police reform in that way, right? I mean, I think we don't do enough around strip searches. I don't think we do enough around cavity searches. I think that legal reform has limitations because, for instance, you can, you know, that public strip search of Charnese at Corley was clearly unconstitutional, but you can strip search people with a warrant, and you can cavity search them with a warrant, as long as it's done in private, right? So there's many stories from airport policing that happened in the 80s up until now of women being taken and forced and strip searched and cavity searched and being forced to experience monitored bowel movements and the assumption that they are carrying drugs in their bodies that are authorized by the courts, right, under a warrant. And so, and we can think about how much perceptions of black women and women of color, again, as concealers of drugs, as consumers of drugs, drive what is considered reasonable and a reason to give a warrant in a situation like that. So, and if we're fighting the war on drugs, then we need to be fighting police sexual violence as part of that, because it's an integral part of how the war on drugs is waged. So those are the solutions, or at least asking if we look at the war on drugs through the lens of women's experience with policing, how that expands the demands that we make, the solutions that we pursue, and how ultimately I think it really pushes us to a demand of decriminalization immediately, because otherwise police continue to have the power to do all the things I just described for black and brown women.
Thank you. Before I turn to the audience, I wanted to ask Chris and Neil to talk a little bit about solutions, and particularly to focus on the problem of corruption that Chris mentioned earlier, which is so connected to the war on drugs, given so much money, and also the issue of what approaches we should take to achieve these changes. You know, should we go local? Should we be protesting? Should we be documenting horrors? Where do we start?
So, I mean, I'll just talk about the Seattle example of this, and I mentioned before about changing practice. So, just sort of real quickly, we were involved in Seattle for over a decade of incredibly contentious debate and litigation over massive racial disparity and drug arrests. So, in a city where 8% of the population was African American, north of 60% of those being arrested for drugs, and mostly for drug sales, were black. And so there was just this incredible, you know, there was court cases, there was contention, the police were felt like they were under siege, the prosecutors felt like they were under siege, the community was definitely under siege. And so nobody was happy with that situation. And so In sort of a moment of peak crisis, we sat down and started talking about a way out of that situation. And so it didn't involve changing policy. What it did was try to get the police out of the business of arresting people for using drugs. And so what we did was we started talking about a thing called law enforcement assisted diversion. And the original point of that was, could we make arrest the strategy of absolute last resort for drug offenses, and in particular, sales, right? So, it was an easy thing to say, don't arrest someone for possession. Saying, don't arrest somebody who is actually selling drugs out on a corner is a much harder thing to get police to do. And we were able to do that. And so I know that we're short on time. So I won't go into a lot of detail over that, but what we saw was, and we're seeing it in other places, is that if you can get them to pull back from that practice, and they did it very reluctantly. They were dragged kicking and screaming into this. But what happened was it made their life easier. And in a weird way, if you can make their life easier, it makes them more willing to do it. And so what we have seen is, since launching in 2011, drug arrests basically do not happen in Seattle any longer. I mean, we've gone from, 4,000 felony arrests a year to a few hundred felony arrests. Now, that's a few hundred too many, but there has been a massive plummet in that. And what has changed is officer attitude about why they should do an arrest. And we actually have officers who are saying things like, why would I arrest someone for possession of a crack pipe? And we're like, yes, we're happy that you're saying this. We just want to remind you that there was a time when you were, in fact, actively arresting lots of people for possession of a crack pipe. So could you please go and spread that message of the futility of that approach to other officers? So I'll just leave it with that and let Neil talk.
And that's a good jumping off place for my brief comments here. And let me first say that no law or policy ever justifies police misconduct. It just doesn't. The foundation of the work that we do is constitutional based. It should be. I mean, that's what we take an oath to, right? So that should be the foundation. What we're talking about here is accountability. And policing is, quasi-military, top-down driven. So we're dealing with a leadership issue here. And when it comes to accountability, when it comes to the misconduct of our police officers in the streets, at any level, really where we should first go is to their supervisors, to their mid-level management, and start holding them accountable. I want to give a quick example that you can relate to if you're familiar with the Freddie Gray situation in Baltimore, and that's where I'm from. There was a lieutenant who started the pursuit of Freddie Gray by the bicycle officers. He was part of this three-man unit riding around on bicycles. He called out for them to pursue Freddie Gray, which they did. They then apprehended Freddie Gray. He didn't respond to that scene where Freddie Gray was initially, which then led to other things. He failed to give the proper instructions once they apprehended Freddie Gray, still not having probable cause for any type of arrest, but they handcuffed him and it continued. He was responsible for placing Freddie Gray into the transport van. He was responsible for the second stop of pulling him out, shackling him, shackling his feet, placing him back into the van, again, not seatbelted in the van. At every point in that entire scenario, that lieutenant was there and responsible. He should have been the first one held accountable. He should have been the main one held accountable for everything that occurred in that particular instance. So that's one example. As we look at police work in other scenarios, no matter how major, no matter how minor, whether we're talking about, as Harry, as you were talking about, what we call on-view policing, enforcing these drug laws, smelling the marijuana, or say we're smelling the marijuana, and then making the detention and the arrest and the search and everything that comes after that. Again, what are the supervisors doing? Where are the sergeants? How are they guiding? How are they coaching or not coaching or guiding or holding their officers accountable? That's where I think we need to begin with our attention, because then maybe we'll get some good performance or less performance, inappropriate performance from our officers on the street. And I'll wrap up my piece with this. So until we get to the place, and again, I believe that we have to form some sort of policing model where the community really does have oversight of policing, not just when something happens in a review board, but a governance board of the community. They need to be at the beginning controlling the budget. They need to be hiring and firing the chief. They need to be holding mid-level management accountable. And this needs to be done at the community level. Until we get there, there are things that we can do, but it begins with the community rising up, organizing, rising up, you know, putting out good information to the citizens on how to record, how to do it appropriately, how to not get yourself into trouble in doing so, how to talk to and interact with the police when you're doing so, how to report complaints, how to use the tools that are out there, one, for instance, that the ACLU has in recording and filing complaints. We need to do a better job of not just ensuring that our police officers are trained and educated, but ensuring that our citizens are educated in how to do this and how to organize and then place pressure upon our elected officials and police chiefs and sheriffs to demand accountability and to not rest or sleep until we start to see it.
This episode was produced as part of the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville, the daily news and interview podcast covering the world of medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja. MJAgenda.com.
The Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville is brought to you by Cannabis Kamikaze, a professional licensed producer from Canada producing 3 pounds per light. Follow Cannabis Kamikaze on Twitter at Cannabis Kamikaze. That's at Cannabis, K-A-M-I-K-A-Z. Cannabis Kamikaze.
The Marijuana Agenda. Like the liberal agenda, but with profits. Ka-ching.
Hey, this is Willie Nelson for Norman. And I smoke pot and I like it a lot. I learned a long time ago that marijuana is a lot safer than alcohol. There's nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana by adults. It's time we stopped arresting and started respecting those who smoke marijuana responsibly. To learn what you can do to help, contact Normal at NORML.org or call toll-free 888-67-NORMAL.
Health Cannabinoid, your ACMPR experts. Consultation services for medical cannabis. Visit healthcannabinoid.com or call 1-800-906-1383. That's www.healthcannabinoid.com or call 1-800-906-1383. Health Cannabinoid.
Promoting the end of adult cannabis prohibition is easy because we have facts, science, reason, compassion, evidence, truth, and logic on our side. It's even easier when researchers catalog it all for us. Learn how to gather the facts on marijuana use, arrests, seizures, rehabs, drug tests, and more on this edition of Drug War Data Mining.
Today in the Drug War Data Mines, I'm really excited to get to the latest information from the National Survey on Drug Use and Health. This is the survey conducted by our federal government on the marijuana use and other drug use, and in fact, a lot of different health survey questions, but we like to focus on the marijuana ones here. And the latest data have come in for the 2015-2016 state-level data, and this is important. At the state level, they do them 2 years at a time because some of these states are small and the populations are small, so you got to throw more data in it to make it, you know, a reasonable survey. So they do them in two-year chunks. And it's been interesting because since legalization happened in 2012, of course, you know, the Joker to my Batman, Kevin Sabet, and his organization, Project Samuel, Smart Approaches to Marijuana Use Except Legalization, have been fighting against the legalization momentum by claiming that legalization would send the wrong message to the children. What about the children? Won't somebody please think of the children? And how legalization of marijuana would lead to more kids smoking pot, which of course inevitably leads them to using heroin and dying, right? You know, the old gateway theory. And I've been following Kevin Sabet ever since he began this whole Project Sam thing, and actually literally followed him around the state of Oregon when he came to fight our legalization in 2014. And this has been a common refrain from Kevin Sabet, picking on the state of Colorado and pointing out how many kids smoke pot in Colorado and how it's a terrible thing and the world's going to come to an end. I go back to the Washington Post for this first quote. This was 2015. Kevin Sabet in 2015 said, quote, "Now that Colorado has legalized and widely commercialized marijuana, their children use marijuana regularly more than children in any other state." End quote. Colorado kids smoke pot more than kids in any other state. Now, the metric we're going by here is what's known as the monthly use rate. And this is the question to kids, did you smoke pot in the past 30 days? So this is going to catch everybody from the one kid who went to the party and smoked some reefer to the, you know, the stoners hanging out behind shop class that are smoking every day, right? Everybody who's smoked at least once in the past 30 days. And indeed, when he said that, Colorado teens did lead the nation, number one out of all the states in their monthly pot smoking rate. Now, this has been a consistent theme from Sabet. We got a quote from, I believe, 2016. Quote, "Once again, Colorado takes the prize for leading the nation in underage pot use. It's no surprise, given that the pot industry is pouring millions of dollars a year into promoting the use of their addictive products." End quote. Again, Colorado, it's terrible. They legalized. Kids there use pot more than they use pot in any other nation. Or any other state, excuse me. And one of the things I pointed out in this is that he noted how Colorado went from fourth in the nation to first in the nation. And I always kind of pointed out that's like saying because Dale Earnhardt Jr. finished fourth in one race and first in the other race, he must have been going faster in the second race. No, it could be the other cars went slower, right? There's all sorts of factors. The rank that you're at doesn't make that much difference. But regardless, that's important to Kevin Sabet. He keeps pointing out, Colorado's number one. It's number one for the teen use of marijuana since they've legalized. And this has gone all the way into 2017. This is from the Project Samuel website at learnaboutsam.org. A post entitled, "Don't Let Anyone Tell You Youth Marijuana Use Hasn't Gone Up in States Like Colorado." According to official statistics, Colorado shows increase in teen use since before legalization. 18 to 25-year-old rate and overall 12 and older rate also up. This is from this spring. A significant increase from 9.82% to 12.56% amongst those Colorado teens smoking pot. And they also like to point out that there's the federal survey, and then there's a couple of state surveys, and the state surveys ask the questions differently, and have the model of data, but yada, yada, yada. They just saying, you know, the sky's falling. Kids in Colorado smoke pot more than kids in any other state. They're number one. It's the worst thing in the world. All right, so now that we got you set up for that, let's take a look at the latest data, shall we? This is the latest data from the survey that we're talking about, the National Survey on Drug Use and Health. And I've just helpfully picked out four of the states there. Now, the red line there is the state of Colorado. That's the Colorado 12 to 17-year-olds. We'll call them teenagers. Teen monthly toking rate in percentage. Then in the, blue line, we got the state of Alaska. In the green line, we have my home state of Oregon. And in the purple line, we got the state of Washington. Now, this graph goes all the way back to 2002. And then it skips a few years because there wasn't data from those years. And all the way to the most recent data. Now, there's a vertical line running down that chart. It's kind of red and purple colored line there. That's where legalization happened. And you can see, indeed, that red line went up quite a bit after legalization, spiked, if you would say, and the blue, and the purple line went up a bit too. You know, Washington went up a bit, but what has it done in the past two surveys? Well, you can see that red line has plummeted. Colorado's teen use of marijuana has plummeted since legalization. And that purple line has declined as well. Washington's teen use of marijuana has declined since legalization. So remember, Kevin Samet said it was a big deal that Colorado was number one. Colorado, most kids in the nation they're using. In fact, this is the data he was going off right there. Here's the table. And looking at those states, the ones that are in dark green, those are your legalization states. And the ones in light green, those are your medical marijuana states, right? So, yeah, Colorado was number one. Look at that column of 2014 through 2015. You can see it. Colorado was number one, 11.13% 2 years ago there. And Vermont was number two. Alaska was number three. Oregon was in the top 10, right? Colorado, number one in the nation. But when we sort that chart there by the 2015-2016 column, you'll notice what happened. Colorado dropped from number one in the nation to number seven. Gee, that's not as scary a talking point, is it, Kevin, when the Colorado goes from number one in the nation to number seven? Because remember, it was a big deal when they went up from fourth to first, right? So it must be a big deal when they declined from first to seventh, isn't it? You'd think. Oh, yeah, and what else? Washington also dropped all the way to number 15th. It was already 15th, but it stayed down there at number 15. It didn't go up many. Now, I will concede that Oregon moved up a spot, it looks like. One spot, two spots, whatever, but Washington and Colorado seeing huge declines. And this is the biggest point to be made. If you compare the increase, the rate of increase, like let's say, you know, you had a 10% and you went up to 11%. That's an overall increase of 10%, right? A relative increase from year to year, right? We can sort by that relative last year increase. And when we do, we find something really interesting. We find that Nevada, not Colorado, not Washington, not Oregon, not Alaska, not the states that already had legalization, but Nevada, a state that has legalized since this survey has been taken, but hadn't legalized yet, Nevada had a relative increase of 17% in teen monthly toking. New Mexico had a relative increase of 10.85, almost 11% in teen monthly toking. Nebraska, a state that's not medical, not legal, barely decrim, a prohibition state, Nebraska had a 9% increase in monthly teen toking. And you'll find also in that list the prohibition states of Louisiana, Ohio, South Dakota, Tennessee, Iowa, and Alabama all posting increases in their monthly teen toking. Now, if your argument is that legalization in Colorado has led to this great explosion in teen toking, then what the hell's going on in Nebraska? But here's even a better look at this chart. Sort it in the reverse order. Which state had the greatest decrease in teen toking? Looky there. It's Colorado. Number one. Colorado is number one once again. Can you believe it? And remember, Kevin Smet said Colorado being number one is a big deal. And there it is. Colorado, of all 50 states in the U.S., had the greatest relative decrease in its teen marijuana use rates. A decrease of 18.44%. Also showing great decrease, number five on the list, Washington State, with a relative decrease of 13.5%. Regulation is working. Public education campaigns are working. They're making sense. The teenage access, the teenage use is going down. And this is despite the fact that these kids don't think marijuana use is any big deal anymore. Right? They used to rate it really high as far as how dangerous it is to use, how disapproved we should disapprove of it. It's awful. It's a terrible thing. That's declining, and their use is going down in the legal states. And this can be looked back all the way. Let's look all the way back to 2012, folks. Let's take it back to 2012, and you'll find the greatest decreases in teen toking rates since 2012 is in Hawaii at 30.5%, but also in the top five, Washington State and Colorado. In fact, the teen toking rate in Colorado right now is lower than what the teen toking rate was in 2002, the beginning of this data chart.
What we are finding is that regulation works, and what we're also going to find is that the rates that increased in Oregon and Alaska, my prediction, you look two surveys down the road, you're going to see a similar decline. They're running out of talking points, folks. They ain't got much left to say. The data keeps showing them to be liars. Interested in only one thing, maintaining the supremacy of the pharmaceutical drugs over the natural ones. That's all the time we got for today. Thanks for joining us. Great to be back from vacation.
Follow MD Agenda on Facebook.
We'll see you later.
Instagram.
And until next
YouTube,
time.
And follow MD Agenda Show on Twitter. Learn more at MJAgenda.com.
You take a seat, you manage, you grow it, you try it, you roll it, you smoke it. You take a seat, you manage, you grow it, you try it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth.